From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 2016 when the Landmark Society of Western New York named its five to revive, the five places, spaces, or things deemed in need of investment for historic preservation. 2016's list included the field of the traditional trades. To quote the Landmark Society, "To rehabilitate a historic building correctly, you need a professional trained in the appropriate skills, such as carpentry, masonry, stained or decorative glass, painting, roof repair, metalwork, and window restoration," end quote. The pandemic has devastated different segments of the economy, but trade jobs are still in demand. Many of the experts in the field are nearing retirement, and as the Landmark Society has said, there's an impending crisis in filling the gap with younger, trained craftspeople. To help create a pipeline for future members of the field, the Landmark Society has teamed up with SUNY Geneseo, Genesee Country Village and Museum, and Perry Main Street to offer a three-part course series called Historic Preservation and Rural Renewal. The series wrapped up last month, and students learned about historic preservation theory, window restoration, and a lot more. So this hour, we talk with instructors and students about historic preservation, how they will apply their skills in the field, and how the future of the traditional trades is looking now. I'd like to welcome our guest. The Director of Preservation for the Landmark Society of Western New York is Caitlin Mivas. Caitlin, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Lytton Smith is Director of the Center for Integrative Learning at SUNY Geneseo. Lytton, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Evan. Great to be with you.
The man from Pain in the Glass is here. It's the best name of any business or company ever, Steve Jordan. Pain in the Glass is a window repair and restoration company. That is really, really good. I just want to keep saying that. Pain in the Glass. Hi, Steve.
Thank you, Wayne. I'm glad to be here.
Did you come up with that yourself?
I think a lot of friends were sitting around. I was sitting around in a room with a lot of alcohol, I believe the former owner of House Parts, Karen Caulfield, may have come up with that.
Pain in the Glass.
There you go.
Steve's the best. And Daisy Goldstein Cross is a local resident who took all three historic preservation courses. Daisy, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
All right. So, Caitlin Mivas, just a little bit of background here. When we go back 5 years, remind listeners what was going on and why the traditional trades ends up as one of the five to revive.
Yeah. So one of the things that I and my colleagues do at Landmark Society is, you know, homeowners will call us up or developers will call us up and say, hey, I've got this problem. You know, my porch is falling down. What do I do? And we try and connect them with contractors and tradespeople who, you know, specialize in that type of work. Because when you're dealing with older buildings, you can't just call up any old general contractor to do most of the work. Most of it's pretty specialized. And so we just found, you know, there's like Steve's the one guy who does window repair. And, you know, maybe there's two or three folks who do porch repair. Maybe, you know, there's one or two people who do stained glass repair. There's a couple of masons out there. So we just, it's, you know, very apparent, and all of these people are incredibly busy and hard to get on a job because their services are in such demand. So, you know, it was obvious that there's a definite problem and a definite demand for this type of work.
And so now, if you fast forward 5 years here, right here in the midst of a pandemic, I know there's still a lot of demand. And ultimately, what's the goal in creating this partnership and putting all of this together, Caitlin?
Yeah, I mean, so the classes that we just had in January are kind of, you know, the first step, a stepping stone in our partnership with SUNY Geneseo. We hope to be able to grow it. The ultimate goal is to have some kind of formal training program, opportunity to get more folks involved in these traditional trades fields, and, you know, maybe to provide some kind of workforce development opportunity for folks, you know, in the city and in our rural areas that need jobs and that need, you know, a trade.
So let me go to Steve Jordan now. And, you know, so Steve, as a royal pain in the glass yourself, what has this pandemic been like in terms of work for you? And can you describe for the audience a little bit about what the actual work is? I mean, we talk about window repair, but what kind of windows are we talking about?
Well, the windows that I work on range from, I'd say, about 1820 to 1940. Mm-hmm. And so the windows would vary from handmade and primitive with no balance system at all to the old rope and pulley windows, which so many of us are familiar with. My work ranges from simple repairs, in other words, doing the least amount or the least expensive amount of work that you can do to make the windows work again, to a complete restoration, which would involve removing the windows and stripping all the paint and taking the glass out and renewing the balance system. So it's everything in between. I have to say that when I started this, it was mostly repairs, and it has evolved into mostly restoration.
Why do you think that is?
I think people are learning that you can have. I think it's an educational thing. I think people have learned that it's possible to do this, that the service is available, and some people will price a restoration as compared to a new window, and they choose the restoration. Not everybody, but a lot of people.
Okay, and how has the demand or just the steady workflow changed for you, if at all, during this pandemic?
I find myself surrounded by a group of peers who work on old houses. They're carpenters and masons and painters and other window professionals. I don't know anyone who has lost a single day's work. Now, I want to qualify that, okay? That's those of us who work with one or two people. The companies that had large staffs of employees, they had to lay them off for a while, and so they lost a lot of time and will probably be behind in their schedules for another year because of this. But those of us who work with one or two or three people didn't lose any work at all.
Wow. And when you are doing this kind of work, is it primarily residences, not sort of commercial buildings? I mean, is it houses? Where are you?
I choose to work in the residential field. I choose not to work in commercial field. I'm one of these very, very opinionated, prejudiced people that feel like when you work for a general contractor, you lose control of your own schedule. You're not working for yourself any longer, and I don't want to do that.
Well, okay? I don't know if that's prejudice. That's just true, right?
It's true.
Yeah. And let me also then kind of get into a little bit of the work here, because we're talking about windows, as you said, from 1820 to 1940. First of all, Steve, do you occasionally come across jobs where you think, man, they don't make them like they used to anymore? This is beautiful or interesting. Is it more interesting to look at that kind of work?
It is more interesting, and I'm not a purist. I have the education to be a purist, but I'm not. And I will occasionally see a house with windows that I think you're just as well off to replace them. Okay, I'm completely willing to admit that. But on the other hand, I frequently see windows that are of such high quality that almost no amount of money could buy them today because of the materials and the quality of the construction. Just this week on Saturday, I went in a house in the Park Avenue neighborhood, and I'm so pleased to tell you all this. Rochester Colonial had come in and looked at the windows and said, these are too good to replace. You know, that's an amazing thing that happened. And they were right. They were too good to replace.
You're giving credit to the company for recognizing that, it sounds like.
I am.
That's great to hear.
Yes.
No, that's very heartening to hear, especially if you're potentially...
Replacement window companies are in the business to sell new windows.
Yeah. Yes.
And they have done that several times over the years, I have to say.
I had a window consultation a couple of months ago. I'm very familiar with how that works.
No, okay, yeah.
It's amazing how often they get you thinking, and have you thought about this one over here? This one could go. Yeah, absolutely. So I am heartened to hear that. But, Steve, the kind of work that you are doing compared to, say, and you mentioned Colonial, but we're pick any company that's doing new windows. How many people in Rochester can do that work, whether it's for them or Anderson or anybody else, and how many can do the kind of work you're doing with windows from 1820 to 1940?
Most every contractor and general contractor in the city is able to install a replacement or a new window. There's two kind of windows. There's a new construction window, which would go into a new house, and if you put it into an old house, it affects the finishes from the inside to the out. That's difficult. So in most old houses, a replacement window is used, and that just fits into the existing opening. And that's the bread and butter of every contractor in town, okay? There are very few people in town that do what I do. There's a couple of other companies that are capable, but I think in terms of the very, very old windows and the restoration and the way I do it, I'm the only one in town. There are other, I call them old house carpenters in town, who are completely able to do this work too, but they choose not to, okay? I think most carpenters who know how to do this find it tedious, and they would rather not. But if it's all you do, then it's not so tedious.
Well, so tell me a little. I want to ask all of you then about some of this coursework and what you've been, Steve, what you've been trying to teach and how it's going. So my understanding is you offered, what, 4 half-day Saturday sessions for hands-on window restoration?
Yeah, we had 4 half-day sessions. I was generally pleased with what I was able to convey. I was pleased with the questions and what I think or hope that they learned. I was restricted by COVID. I would like to have had a lot more hands-on participation. You know, I'd like to say, hey, all of you huddle around. Let's look at this closely. I'd like to have grabbed a few people's hands to help them when they were trying to cut glass or glaze the window, but I couldn't do any of that. Otherwise, though, it went very well, and we depended a lot on PowerPoints and handouts and physical pieces and parts to hand around a room.
What are people asking most commonly, Steve? Is it about the broader questions about the work and whether you can find work doing this, or is it more on the technical side?
These people were not looking for work. Most of them, unfortunately, most of these people were homeowners who wanted to do their own homes. Okay, there were 2 or 3 people in the room who were interested in historic preservation and may be interested in doing it, but I think it's a wait and see. Okay,
Daisy, why did you do it?
Well, I was excited about all 3 of the classes, and it was pitched to me, and I said I love to work with my hands and try hands-on stuff, so. You know, I love historical buildings and thought it was a great opportunity. And it was super interesting and intriguing. And Steve really captivated why the windows are really important. I'm in my living room right now looking out my ripply glass. So I love it.
What glass are you looking at?
How the old windows have waves and ripples in them. And Steve taught us a lot about the production of old glass that is, you know, no longer made the way that it used to be made. So it has a character that's really special.
Mm. What do you imagine you're going to be using some of these skills for most often, Daisy?
Well, I'm a crafts person. I currently am doing ceramics, and I love to work with my hands. And I'm kind of at a point in my life where I'm trying to figure out what my next career path is. And I'm actually planning on working with Steve a little bit and getting more hands-on experience in window restoration and deciding if the crafts and the trades are for me. So, yeah.
Incredible. Incredible. So let me ask Caitlin and Litton a little bit more about this. Now, first of all, Caitlin, when you hear Steve describing the work here, I'm really glad to hear, I will say, Caitlin, Steve say that, you know, a pretty significant local company told a homeowner these windows are too good to replace. That's a good sign. That's a sign that there's a real, I think, affection for understanding history and preservation. How did that hit you, that story? I'm sure you've heard that already.
Yeah, no, that's always, you know, heartening to hear. And I do think Steve's right. I think there is more of an awareness out there just in the general homeowner community that windows are capable of being repaired. You know, most of us were never told or taught that that's a thing. So I do think that's improving. And I think, you know, Steve made a good point when he said, you know, he chooses to work on strictly residential houses. You know, it's a good point. He can afford, there's enough demand for his work that he can afford to be choosy about what projects he takes on. You know, so that just tells you that there is a lot of demand out there for this kind of work.
Absolutely. Litton Smith is director of the Center for Integrative Learning at SUNY Geneseo. So tell me about the role here and the value of integrated learning here, Litton.
Yeah, absolutely, Evan. So it gives us a chance to connect what students are learning in their academic disciplines to the communities that they're a part of, and particularly in the Genesee Valley. So one of the really exciting things about historic preservation, I think you can already hear this from this call, is how much care and how much community building goes into historic preservation. And so we've got students who've got great skills in research, in analysis, in communication, in leadership and collaboration, and they can bring that mindset to understanding the kinds of things that Steve is trying to teach and understanding a new look at the kind of building stock that you've got in Rochester and the surrounding area. So it's this really great match between ethics and culture and hands-on skills that we're really excited to be partnering on.
And Litton, as Steve mentioned, you know, this kind of work, teaching people how to get it, how to gain these skills would be easier. Everything would be easier if we weren't in a pandemic here. How much are you able to, you know, able to do right now? How limited do you feel?
You know what? I'm really feeling so grateful to have amazing colleagues at SUNY Geneseo who have just embraced the opportunities of the pandemic. It's a tough time for everybody. It's a tough time for higher ed. But the way that colleagues have just innovated using Zoom and other remote tools have meant that, you know, while there's a definite loss here, we've been able to create some new ways of exciting and engaging students. And in fact, we were having students come in from across and outside the state, which wouldn't have been possible in person. So, you know, you kind of make hay while the sun shines, right? And we're looking forward to getting back to normal and back to face-to-face, as Steve was saying. But there's really exciting things we can do in the meantime.
Talking about the skilled trades, we're talking about a new opportunity through this collaboration among Landmark Society of Western New York, SUNY Geneseo Center for Integrative Learning, and you're hearing Litton Smith, the director. Steve Jordan is with us, who has been teaching students like Daisy, who is just one of the students there. And Daisy, how much time did you have to commit to do this?
Well, the course was over January, and I took all three sections. So we had two of the more lecture-based classes were 3 days, almost a full day of lecture on Zoom, and then the window restoration class was on Saturdays for the month of January, and that was in the mornings at Genesee Country Museum, which is fantastic and was great to be on site there and get a little in-person engagement.
That's great. Let me work through a little bit of feedback already. Daisy is just one of the students we're going to be talking to this hour, but let me just squeeze in some feedback. Joel says, what do your guests suggest a homeowner do when they have an older house, say 1903, that has already had a previous homeowner remove the old windows and put in plastic replacement windows that have already failed? Steve Jordan, can I ask you about that one?
Well, yeah, I do have an opinion. That homeowner has two options, really. They have an option of a replacement window or a replica window of the originals. And with a replacement window, if they were to go that route, I would choose a replacement company that makes a wood window that has the proportions that are similar to what the original windows had. But the other option, which is very important, and most people don't think about this, is that there are many sash makers around the country, and some not far from here, that will make a replica window. They'll make a replica window that not only is made out of a species of wood that will not rot, they'll also weather strip that window with products that are better than what you would get on a replacement window. So it's possible to put the windows back to look exactly like they did when they were new, when the house was new.
Wow. Wow. Daisy, can you imagine having a house 1903 and just thinking we're going to rip out those old windows and we'll just, you know, put something sort of cookie cutter in there?
I mean, I live in an 1850s farmhouse out in Geneseo, and We have a lot of the original windows, but the bay window was replaced before we moved in, and it kind of breaks my heart because it's so you can see the difference between, I mean, the old wavy, ripply glass and the character of the old windows versus the replacements, and it's just, I mean, it just breaks my heart. So it's exciting to be able to participate in something that can, you know, save those windows that are, you know, they really preserve the history of the region and, you know, the beauty of the craftsmanship that used to exist here.
Sure. And Steve, I mean, I am sure homeowners will ask you whether it's a, you know, an 1850s farmhouse like Daisy mentioned, or Joel mentioning a house from 1903. I'm sure one of the questions is, well, if we preserve this, or, you know, if we want to work with what we have here, how safe is it? Safe with the old glass, leading, et cetera. Are you pretty comfortable kind of assessing safety, and how often does that come up?
Well, safety is important in all the trades, okay? Every trade has different dangers. The first thing I'd like to say is in a residence, glass is generally the least of my safety concerns. The glass is no more dangerous or like to break in an old window as it is in a new window, unless the windows have rotted and the glass is falling out of the wall, which can happen. But the bigger concerns with this are lead, and lead and asbestos. So while the glass is a concern, that can be handled safely with care. The safe removal or work around lead and asbestos is a little trickier, although our county governments will provide booklets about how to remove lead safely. Okay.
Yeah, and you know, Steve, your knowledge on this subject, I mean, I would feel wonderful if I had a complicated project and I had someone like you doing it. But what is the pipeline? What does it look like for people who are, not to date you, but younger than you, who are going to be doing this career, you know, for decades to come, Steve? Is the pipeline large enough right now?
That's a good question. I think that there are ample opportunities for people who want to work in the trades, or I would rather say the historic preservation trades, okay? There are ample opportunities. But as you know, we don't have the greatest economy in the world here. And so generally, to learn these things, you may have to work for someone who splits their workload between doing modern work and old work. That's very common. I do know two or three carpenters who only do old work. I do know masons who only do old work. Whether or not they would hire someone or not, I'm not sure, but most everyone over the years has had trouble getting good help, okay? And what we're all looking for is enthusiasm, ability to learn and enthusiasm. And I think, you know, I had a room full of enthusiastic people for every Saturday over the last month. I'm not sure I answered your question.
I think you did. And then I want to read an email from Dennis that kind of dovetails with this question. And I think all of our guests can offer some perspective here, because when we look at the pipeline, it's a question of how young it should start, whether our society is educating, especially, you know, middle and high school students about possibilities. So this is what Dennis wants to know. He says, are high school guidance counselors aware of the career opportunities for such work and the good standard of living they provide? And are there the type of courses offered in high schools where students can discover their aptitude and enjoy the enjoyment of the craft and the arts professions? That's a different thing than what we're talking about, this partnership with SUNY Geneseo and Landmark. Steve, does it go into K-12?
High schools are not offering trade courses. You may know that in the past, large high schools offered shop, and they discontinue that. And those of us who want to train people in the trades find that disheartening, because if you have a room full of people that come to you and you need to teach them something and they need to use power equipment, then you would have a room full of people with various experience, somewhere between some experience, good experience, and none. So you have to start at the bottom. If you have people in there, even if they say they know how. You have to teach them the very fundamentals of using power equipment and the safety measures. And therefore, you would waste weeks on information that in the past many students would have gleaned from high school trade classes, shop class, okay? So I hope that counselors are aware of it. You know, I'm an old guy. I don't know what they're telling the children now. I think we've had a problem. We've had a problem for years now where everyone has to go to college, and people go to college and get out and find that maybe it wasn't the best thing for them. They don't like working in a cube, or maybe they don't make enough money, or whatever. But
generally, you think
over that.
Yeah, I mean, Steve. I mean, I'm not as young as I used to be. I will say, I remember shop class growing up, and you're saying that most schools now, they don't have shop anymore?
Not that I know of.
Okay. I mean, Daisy, what's your recollection?
I'm really glad you asked, because I did have shop, I think, in junior high school. And I found, like, the shop led to engineering, and I'm an artistically minded person as well, and the dichotomy of that was art. And I think that high school, and I also found a lot in my college education, is really, you know, it really dissects art and science and craft and thinks that they're really different. And I think historical preservation, at least for me as someone who's interested in science and art, really is a beautiful pathway between combining those two things. And, you know, I think that it's important to, you know, show kids, okay, well, this is shop class. You're not just cutting this ugly piece of wood and nailing it to another ugly piece of wood that you got at Lowe's. It can be, you know, something that is really beautiful and, you know, connective with history and culture.
Absolutely. Caitlin Mivas, you want to add to that? I mean, I don't know how much, you know, Landmark gets to pop into high schools or even middle schools, but generally speaking, how do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're not, as a society, we don't necessarily give young kids like the full breadth of what their opportunities and potential career paths are. And, you know, I think a lot of us just get on, you know, the college and grad school track, just because that's kind of what's assumed that one should do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think this is starting to change, but I think there for many years there was maybe a negative association with working in a trade, that somehow that wasn't as admirable as, say, becoming a lawyer or a doctor. I do think that's starting to change, especially with the student loan crisis. But yeah, I think we need to start early with letting kids know that this is an opportunity, but also, you know, one of the students we'll hear from later is a mid-career professional. So, you know, giving folks, you're never too old to learn something new and to try a different career.
And let me ask Litton Smith to jump in on that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think I agree with everything that people are broadly saying, although there's some great examples out there. If people haven't come across Perry High School's Habitat for Innovation in Education, it's a great example of how there are schools out there who are really introducing students to hands-on skills and getting them involved in problem-solving education. And I think that's what was really exciting to SUNY Geneseo about there, is the chance that we can help students recognize the issues that are out there in the community and say to them, well, how would you contribute to this? What's your role here? And for some of them, that meant, I want to go and work with Steve more. I want to learn more things with my hands. And for others of them, it was, hey, I can get people together, form a community, and we can try and, you know, save a project or get more attention to a project that's already out there.
Well, we're talking to Litton Smith, director of the Center for Integrative Learning at SUNY Geneseo, Caitlin Mivas from the Landmark Society of Western New York, Steve Jordan, the owner of Pane in the Glass, a window repair and restoration company, and Daisy, I'll let you go because we're going to bring in some other students, but I want to say thanks for sharing your thoughts and your experience, Daisy. It's been great talking to you.
It's been great being here. Thanks so much.
Daisy Goldstein-Cross is a local resident who took all three historic preservation courses that these groups have been teaming up to offer, Historic Preservation and Rural Renewal, a series that wrapped last month. But as Caitlin mentioned, you know, sort of a part of what they're hoping will grow and continue to flower in this community, an appreciation for historic preservation, a pipeline to learn skills and then to get jobs in this field. So really interesting stuff. And let's take that only break and come right back with them next. I'm Evan Dawson. On Tuesday, we are monitoring the developments from Washington, ready for the start of the impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump in the United States Senate. NPR will have full coverage of the impeachment trial, and we will make sure it is brought to you live no matter when it begins. Our anticipation, it'll be sometime in the early afternoon, so we're monitoring that. We'll have that for you on Tuesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I want to bring in Jack Pittenger on the phone with us, who is founder of Essex Historical Associates, a museum consulting firm. And he took career pathways in historic preservation and the traditional trades. He's on the line with us now. Hi, Jack. How are you?
Good, thanks, Evan. How are you? Nice to be here.
Good. And tell us a little bit about what you're doing in your career right now, and how this, you know, maybe factors into what you're considering.
Yeah, so my background is primarily as a museum consultant. I got a master's degree in public history from Arizona State University in 2013. That field is centered on making history accessible and relevant to the general public, and I was able to parlay that into a job at a museum consulting firm in Salem, Massachusetts, and I worked there for about 6 or 7 years before I came to Rochester about a year and a half ago. With my family to move here and kind of put out my own shingle. And that's where my the bulk of my background lies, is in interpretation, exhibit development, museum text writing, et cetera. But recently I've had a kind of a change in interest into trying to get into a more hands-on type of field within preservation, which led me to take the course to learn a bit more about the traditional trades.
What did you learn?
I learned that there's an awful lot of opportunity and a need for labor. I believe it was actually Steve Jordan who said on the call that, you know, a lot of folks with this type of knowledge are kind of aging out of the profession. So there could be a real opening and a real opportunity for folks my age and younger to get involved in this field and learn some of these skills that the preservation field so desperately needs right now.
Would you have thought of this 5 years ago? Would you have been surprised to see yourself taking this kind of a course and thinking about doing this?
Yeah, I would have been surprised 18 months ago, quite honestly. It's been quite a shift in my career. But, I think as someone who's a bit more advanced in my career than some of the other folks I was in the class with, I one of the things I really learned, and I actually tried to kind of tell some of the younger folks in the course who seemed a bit stressed about their path, is that your career can be quite a circuitous thing. There's no straight line to get to where you want to be or where you think you should be or what have you. Your interests change, your skills change, what you want out of a job or a career changes. And I think that's a completely natural part of working life. Now, I might not have said that 5 years ago, and certainly not when I graduated from college a million years ago. But now at this point, I think that's where my heart lies.
Yeah. And Jack, before I turn to the other guests on this point, I really think that's a wise sort of point to make here, because probably when you and I were in school, sounds like roughly around the same time. I mean, it was still a time where a lot of people were deciding a career once they reached adulthood and figuring, well, I'll get a job, and if I can, I'll just do that job, and maybe even at that place, wherever that is, for my whole career. And that'll be decades, and then I'll be done at some point, and that's that. And boy, you talk to Gen Z, and there is a real sense that no matter what you're doing at 18 or 22 or 25, you better be adaptable. You better have a lot of skills. You better expect that you might move physically, state to state, town to town. You might move company to company or career to career. It's just a different mentality, isn't it?
I agree 100%. I think, folks might. So I'm 35, so I graduated from undergrad in 2008. So we went right into kind of the jaws of the Great Recession. I think, out of my 15 or 20 closest friends, I think one had a job lined up at the end of school. And so, we were in a rough spot to begin with. But just, yeah, I think you're absolutely right that work life is becoming kind of so fragmented and so, all the safeguards that generations before us could take for granted, staying at the same company, having a pension, you know, getting enough hours to qualify for benefits. Those are things that folks our age can't take for granted. So as you said, I think that having that sort of mental agility to be able to adapt to a new field or a new working situation or even a new physical location, like you said, like I did, it's all part of the puzzle right now as people our age try and kind of make their way through a career environment that maybe the generation or two before us can't quite relate to, I guess.
Absolutely. Litton Smith, when you think about that, I mean, as Dennis, who emailed earlier, was asking about high school, that's obviously valuable to consider to make sure that everyone is being sort of shown the options in front of them. But boy, I mean, there's probably a lot of people like Jack who are figuring things out or refiguring things out at certain ages where they didn't expect it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's increasingly shown by a new number of studies that people are changing jobs more often and getting more careers as well, which is important. And that's one thing that we're really excited about, both within historic preservation, where there are so many different fields, so many different ways to be a historic preservationist, but also, you know, being at a public liberal arts school like SUNY Geneseo is. One of the things we're trying to teach students is it's not to be focused on one single goal. What am I going to do with my life? But what are the skills that are going to help me adapt to numerous contexts and careers? And I'm glad that Jack mentioned he was trying to sort of relieve the stress of some of the students who are about to graduate, because I think there's a reassurance in that. It can be scary to not know what you're going to do, but if you can fall back on thinking, I've got these skills, I can communicate, I can analyze, I can research, I can collaborate with people, then there's huge opportunities for being a useful asset to a number of different contexts.
Well, and Caitlin Mivas, reading this very interesting article titled A Guide to Becoming a Historic Preservation Professional, The Work You Can Do, What Employers Want, and Educational Considerations. A couple of things struck me, especially when I look at your job title, Caitlin Mivas, Director of Preservation for the Landmark Society of Western New York. The authors of this article say that there are a wide range of things that you could do in preservation, but it will almost never include the words preservation or historic preservation in the job title, unless you're Caitlin Mivas, it turns out. But look at the breakdown here. I mean, 70% of jobs in this field are regulatory compliance, 11% architecture and construction. Then you've got 9% historic sites and museums, about 6% preservation advocacy work, and 4% downtown revitalization. Does that sort of set of numbers sound right to you? Do you think that will shift?
Yeah, that actually, those numbers were really interesting. The regulatory compliance taking up such a large percentage was surprising to me. What this is was kind of what we tried to get across in our career pathways course with Geneseo was that we brought in a bunch of different panelists each day to go over these different realms, you know, so you could be an architect or a landscape architect. You know, you might only kind of touch on preservation, say, if you're an architect, or you might be an architect that specializes only in old buildings. So there's just so many different ways that you can come at this field. And it's just a matter of kind of figuring out, I think, like with anything else, what's your niche? Like, where do you fit in? Mm-hmm. Do you want to work for FEMA and do regulatory compliance? Or, you know, do you want to do something like what I do and, you know, work in preservation advocacy? There's just such a broad range of things related to preservation.
Well, and boy, I know Steve George's not doing regulatory compliance. I think you're actually doing a window right now. It sounds like it. Are you okay over there?
Who, me?
Steve Jordan.
Am I doing a window right now? No, I'm not. I'm sitting at my computer.
Oh.
as I talk to you.
I got you. Steve, when you see those numbers, I mean, do you think this field still has room for growth? Not just sort of status quo, but is there room for growth?
Oh, I think there's a lot of room for growth. I really do. And I... as I said earlier, we don't have the greatest economy in the world, but education makes a big difference in the growth. And I know of people in Florida where they do have a booming economy, and they have work that's unbelievable, a workflow, amount of work, a lot of employees, and it's growing fast. But I don't want to be too negative about here. Because I have a friend in Buffalo doing window restoration, and he has 12 employees. So there are great opportunities here. There are opportunities to
work alone without a boss, and there's opportunities to have a crew and make real money.
Absolutely.
Okay?
Well,
I think, and that's true in masonry and carpentry and stained glass and all the various bits and pieces of historic preservation.
Well, Jack, before I let you go, last question then for you. What do you think you're going to do next?
Well, as a result of this course, actually, I've been made a few introductions with some folks within the trades. My main area of interest, Steve, one of the fields Steve just mentioned, I'd like to transition into masonry. And so as a result of this course and then the folks who ran it, I've been able to make some connections that are pretty promising. So I'm committed to heading down this path right now, doing this sort of mid-career transition that I feel that the course kind of not only set me up for, but kind of validated the idea that it's okay, it's acceptable to make these types of switches. There's no, as I said earlier, there's no set path. So I found that very validating, very exciting, and I'm looking forward to seeing where this transition in the trades takes me.
Thanks for making time for the program today, Jack. Really interesting stuff.
Thank you very much, Evan. Appreciate it.
Jack,
have a good day.
Yeah, Jack Pettinger is the founder of Essex Historical Associates, a museum consulting firm who took the course, Career Pathways in Historic Preservation and the Traditional Trades, and at 35, looking at some real shifts in what he is thinking about for his own future. So exactly what these partners who've been working together on these courses have been thinking about. Let me squeeze in a phone call from Dan in Farmington, and then I'm going to bring in another guest. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. Keep it tight.
Hey, just wanted to say real quick, I think a big issue with getting people into the trades is that there's a negative connotation to blue-collar work, that if you do blue-collar work or you're in a skilled trade, that you couldn't cut it in college or, you know, you're less than. And I think if we could get past that, we could fill the trades with more people more easily if there wasn't that stigma from society. That's it.
Yeah, Dan, thank you very much for that. Steve Jordan, is that still true? I mean, we've talked about that in the past in this program. Is that less so today than it used to be?
I think it may be less so today. I think it's still a problem, mm-hmm. but I think it's less a problem today than it used to be, for sure. You know, my father, who was born in 1917, used to tell me as a kid, you got to go to college because during the Great Depression, only the people that went to college had a good, secure job. Okay, well, that's certainly not true anymore, is it? I do think it's changing.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me bring in Olivia Schoenfeld, who's a senior at SUNY Geneseo, who took a historic preservation course, who's on the line with us now. Hi, Olivia. How are you?
Yeah. Hi. Good. How are you?
Good. So, let's just start right on that point here. I mean, that's something that Steve Jordan and others have joined us on this program in the past to talk about, is the idea of how people who are not in traditional trades view that field, and maybe certain stigmas or stereotypes that have lessened over the years. How do you view the field?
Yeah, I can definitely agree with that, you know, stigma that's out there. I am interested more in conservation, and that has definitely taken a turn, I guess, in the past, you know, a few decades of turning from a trade more into you need graduate degree work. Mm-hmm. So that's the field that I'm hoping to get into, but I can completely understand how, you know, there is that stigma that I wish wasn't there, and especially in preservation. I did the course on the intro to historic preservation and the theory, and we talked about that a lot, and I can see it still in conservation, just this thought that you can only have one track that is a formal education, when that's really not necessarily true.
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, as you know, Olivia, I mean, whether it's conservation, historic preservation, I mean, these fields don't exist without the traditional trades. And maybe I'm naive, but I really want to think that your generation is going to view these fields, you know, with much more respect, and the respect that they deserve, especially because, yeah, with the student debt crisis, I think we're all learning a lot of hard lessons here. But what do you want to do with how did the course go for you, Olivia, and what do you want to do next with it?
Yeah, the course was great. I think I was really surprised by how many, you know, individuals and groups, like even the panel discussions we had, there are so many passionate people in this field, and it's just like, it's really nice to see. And I guess not everyone has, you know, preservation as a household name and word that's thrown around. So it was it was great to see that there are so many people. So I think everything that I'm taking from the course, I really do hope to bring into my career in conservation in the future. So I think I found a lot of parallels, which were nice to highlight. And yeah, I overall really enjoyed it.
5 years from now, 10 years from now, ideally, Olivia, what are you doing?
I would say I want to be in a museum and a conservator working, you know, on contemporary art pieces. Being a preservationist, I think, will always be a part of that. Just advocating for that, you know, cultural significance being, you know, integral to the pieces, historical sites, whatever they may be. I think that's something that I'll always try to carry.
Well, and so, Caitlin Mivas, what we're hearing from three different students, I mean, students, people have taken these courses, it's a diversity in backgrounds and desires for using this information and these skills in their own lives. And I think that's great, but we're talking about a course series that you guys have already done. What do you do next? For people listening now, you know, I want to ask you and Litton what you want people to know about what could happen next here.
Yeah, well, you know, Litton and Landmark Society and I and SUNY Geneseo, we're going to put our heads together. But, you know, my kind of pie in the sky dream for 5 to 10 years from now is, you know, that we have some kind of formal program where folks from, especially from, you know, maybe lower income backgrounds have the opportunity to get formal training in the trades and to take that in whatever, you know, whether they're interested in masonry or windows, to take that in whatever direction they want to, that they feel passionate about and have, you know, a viable career. And I think, you know, I think in terms of the negative perceptions about the trades, I think social media is helping dispel some of that. There's a huge old house community on Instagram, you know, and people repairing their houses. So I do think it's improving.
Litton, what do you see as happening next year? What's the potential for this?
Yeah, I mean, as Caitlin suggested, we want to build some more formal programs so that more and more people from more and more different backgrounds can start to access the field of historic preservation and discover that there's a huge set of riches there to explore, and that this is a good area in the country to be doing it, that there is plenty of opportunity and there's plenty of need, and as people have kept saying, that the need is only going to increase. But we're also thinking, you know, more widely. I mean, this project arose through Nicole Monopole, who's the community development specialist at SUNY Geneseo, working with partners to recognize that need and to say, well, how can a public liberal arts school meet that need? And so we're also looking at other programs where we can connect workforce development to public liberal arts and really make sure that we're getting that both and, where it's not you're either doing a trade or you're at college, but these two things go hand in hand together, because that's what we see when we talk to practitioners, is that they value the skills that you might learn in the philosophy or the history classroom or through art history, and they want to teach the skills that will help you, you know, think about the context of a house as well as the hands-on work of masonry or stained glass or whatever it is.
Absolutely. Let me try to squeeze in one more phone call. Jacob in Rochester. Hi, Jacob. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I was wanting to talk about if you'd work with minority communities, which you just touched on, and refugees communities, particularly refugees, for refugees or keeping our promise.
Caitlin Mivas, working with outreach to minority or refugee communities. What do you think, Caitlin?
Yeah, I think that would be, you know, that's definitely what we want to look at as we try to develop a formal trades training program, is to get to communities who need jobs and who haven't been afforded, you know, opportunities historically. So that's definitely something we want to look at focusing on.
Okay. Jacob, I appreciate that. And let me see here, just because, boy, we've been filled up with phone calls, and I appreciate all of the interest and listeners all day here, all hour long. Let me just squeeze in. Lisa, you got to do it in 30 seconds or less. Go ahead, Lisa.
Hi. I'm just thrilled to hear this program and about a pipeline being developed. I'm wondering if you're working with the city's community wealth building initiative and some of the other programs they've got, block grant funding, to do, because in the 19th century housing stock in the city, it's just so sad to watch beautiful hardwoods that can't be found again because they don't exist anymore, being landfilled because people have been sold a bill of goods that, you know, replacement windows will be efficient. It's not green. it's not economical, and we've got a huge group of young people who could be doing this work because there's not enough Steve Jordans.
Lisa, thank you. Real tight, Caitlin. What
thank
do you think?
You, Lisa.
Yeah, yes. You know, we're going to leave no stone unturned in trying to reach out to different partners beyond SUNY Geneseo to try and make this happen.
And Steve Jordan, on the kinds of homes she's talking about, we all know there's a beautiful housing stock. How concerned are you about making sure it's preserved? Steve, 30 seconds.
Oh, I'm very concerned. I used to live in the heart of the city, and I saw a slow, gradual deterioration of melting of the housing stock all around me that was very disturbing, and I think something needs to be done to pull us out of this.
Well, I really appreciate the perspectives of all of our guests who are working towards that. And, Steve, you know, you're educating so many people, and thank you for sharing the expertise with our listeners. Steve is the owner of Pain in the Glass, a window repair and restoration company. As always, Steve, thank you.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Our thanks as well to Olivia Schoenfeld. Olivia, thanks for sharing your thoughts on taking the course, and good luck in your future.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
You got it. Litton Smith, Director of the Center for Integrative Learning at SUNY Geneseo. Thank you, Litton.
Thanks, Evan.
Caitlin Mivas, Director of Preservation for the Landmark Society of Western New York. Always appreciate the time, Caitlin.
Thanks, Evan. Happy to be here.
And just judging by the feedback, I love when we talk traditional trades because people are so engaged in it. So we'll keep doing that. For now, though, we say thanks for listening this afternoon. And Megan Mack has been producing and engineering. I'm Evan Dawson. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.